Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Opinions and views of host and guests are not necessarily opinions and views of the Blake Radio Network.
Hello, this is Dr. Jennifer Daniels, and you are listening to The Lethal Dose, Why Is Your Doctor Prescribing It? And the name of the show is Navigating the Health, the Disease Creation System. Now, I was trained as a medical doctor and received a medical degree from the University of Pennsylvania. And I did my pre-med studies at Harvard University. And for 10 years, I practiced as a board-certified family practice physician. And the first thing from my mind was the idea that the healthcare I was trained to deliver might actually be lethal. The awareness crept up on me slowly and slowly as I noticed not only were people not getting better, but they actually appeared to be getting worse. And so this sparked in me an awareness that it was not a healthcare system, not a disease care system, but actually a disease creation system. And by way of talking about the lethal dose and why is your doctor prescribing it, I want to first talk about what lethal is and how that concept was introduced to me in medical school. Lethal dose means the amount of something, usually a medication or a chemical, that causes death. And in medical school, we were taught about something called LD50. And LD50 is the dose of a drug at which 50% of those who take it die, actually drop dead. You can imagine, to my young, tender ears, the thought of administering anything that could kill half of the people who receive it was just appalling, shocking. And so, of course, I asked the unthinkable question, what about the LD0? What about giving a dose of a medication that didn't kill anybody? And in medical school, I was taught, nope, no such dose. Somebody's going to die every dose, but the benefits outweigh the risk. And this always troubled me. And I kind of put it out of my mind and, consoled myself with the usual excuses we were given, which is that research is ongoing, and that better solutions would be found and ways to make things safer. And even though things might not be as safe as we like right now, that they're getting safer every day. So that's how the concept of the lethal dose was introduced in medical school. And then it finally occurred to me as I was practicing medicine, actually one thing happened in medical school. There's this drug called Coumadin, and you may know someone who takes it or you may have heard of it. It helps thin the blood. And there's this condition called atrial fibrillation. The heartbeat is irregular. And so we were taught that when a person first gets an irregular heartbeat, it's very important to thin their blood for a period of 3 months with this special medicine and then stop the medicine because it saves lives. And I said, wait a minute, if this drug is so good, why don't we continue it longer? Why don't we do even more good? And so, of course, I asked my professor this, and he said, well, the reason we don't continue it more than 3 months is because at the three-month point, the number of lives saved by preventing a stroke due to atrial fibrillation is equal to the number of deaths caused by people bleeding to death from Coumadin. So at the three-month point then, everything's a wash. And I found this a little troubling because, wait a minute, I'm going to give this drug till it kills as many people as it would have saved. So the total number of people who die is the same whether I give the drug or whether I don't, because the dosing schedule that I'm given is guaranteed to create at least as many deaths as lives it saves. Now, another odd thing about this is the obvious conflict of interest. If you allow the manufacturers of the drug to decide how many lives the drug is really saving and how many lives the drug is really taking in terms of murdering people. And so obviously, if someone's making this drug, they're going to overestimate the number of deaths the drug prevents and underestimate the number of deaths the drug causes. And it turns out that there's plenty of evidence that this is exactly what has happened. And the evidence is literally 107,000 people every single year who die from properly prescribed medications. These are highly trained doctors who have done their reading, who have kept up with research, and are literally prescribing lethal doses of medication to the detriment of 107,000 people every single year who die from properly prescribed medications. Now, it might not shock you, but that's actually more than the deaths caused by incompetent doctors. Yes, you've guessed it. Your chances of being a victim of medical homicide are actually greater the more highly trained your doctor is and the more competent your doctor is. So the troubling thing, of course, is the underestimation of the death created by the drug, overestimation of the benefit of the drug, and who is making this decision. Now, this is really a shocking or amazing thing. So it turns out then that the lethal dose of medication is often equal to the therapeutic dose. And so just by following the standard of care, a doctor can do a lot of harm. Now, there are drugs that are identified as especially dangerous. And whenever this happens, the FDA says, hey, wait a minute, this drug is killing a lot of people. It's obvious it's killing a lot of people. Something needs to be done about this. And what happens then is the FDA demands that the drug company, through the FDA, do a special mailing to doctors and mail them a special notice telling them, hey, this drug is really, really dangerous. It's killed a lot of people, and we want you to take the following precautions. And I'd like to give an example of this, because these notices the doctors, by the way, go out in the mail all the time, very, very frequently. And this one drug I want to mention is something called Brilinta. And not that Brilinta is especially a bad actor, but it's very typical. And so I want to show you this example so we can point out these things that happen when doctors are educated that lead them to actually prescribe a drug in its deadly dose, even more often as a result of the training. So Brilinta is a drug that is prescribed to help thin the blood, and this is believed to prevent heart attacks. Now, it's important to know that if you have a heart attack, the kind where you get chest pain, you clutch your chest, then your chances of dying of a heart attack are 3.6%. In other words, if a cat has 9 lives, then the average human has 24 heart attacks before they actually die. This is an important thing to understand as you assess the relative benefits of this drug. So, Brilinta has a gross death rate of 2.6% per year. Per year. The death rate from heart attack, if you average it out and you say heart attack kills 50% of people per year, then the per year risk of a person dying of a heart attack is 1.6%. So you're going to take a drug thinning medication, blood thinning medication, that gives you a 2.6% per year death rate in order to avoid a heart attack, which has at most a 1.25% death rate. Okay, so already we have a drug that's nearly twice as deadly as the disease it's supposed to prevent. Now, that would be okay if that's all there was, but it turns out with this drug, you have an 11% chance of bleeding so severely that you require more than 4 units of blood to be transfused. And this is a special alert that they send to doctors, explaining this to doctors, and then telling the doctors, but don't ever stop this drug. The only time you can stop this drug is if you contact the doctor who originally prescribed the drug. Now, nowadays, with medical care, you have group practices. A doctor might change from one group to another group, might move to another state, might not be on call. And so you're only allowed to stop this drug once you talk to the prescribing doctor. So you have in front of you a patient who's bleeding to death, you're transfusing blood, maybe you're on your fourth unit, the sixth unit you're pumping into them, and you should never stop this blood, this drug that caused the bleeding, until you talk to the doctor who prescribed it. Now you would think that in the literature they mail to the doctor, they would say, now when you call the doctor who prescribed the drug, this is what that doctor will do. No. There's no mention anywhere in the literature mailed to the doctor as to what the doctor prescribing the drug ought to do. And so there literally is no provision for this drug to ever be stopped, even as it's causing the patient to die. So this is actually shocking. Notice, had a doctor not received this notice in the mail, he might have said, well, geez, the medicine causes bleeding, a person gets a little bleeding, I'll just stop the drug. But this written instruction to the doctor is very clear. No, you are not to stop the drug. Now, a sensible thinking individual would say, well, that's ridiculous. I'm a doctor, I can decide to stop the drug, and I'm certainly not going to kill somebody with the drug. And it turns out that your doctor knows what to prescribe because he follows something called the standard of care. And the standard of care is these written instructions the doctor receives from the drug company and from the FDA. So the doctor receives this instruction, this is the standard of care, disseminated to him through these mailings, through continuing medical education and textbooks. And it's not something he's free to ignore. When doctors ignore the standard of care, they can lose their hospital privileges, means their right to earn money by working at hospitals. They can be subject, believe it or not, to malpractice lawsuits because the malpractice law is very clear. It says if a doctor fails to adhere to the standard of care, then he can be found liable. So the doctor's in a little bit of a pickle here. If he refuses to prescribe the lethal dose, then he can actually be prosecuted in court for failure to adhere to the standard of care and prescribe a lethal dose. Now, that is really, you can imagine, a high-stress situation to be in. The other situation with the standard of care is insurance payments. Insurance companies inform the doctor that if the doctor does not adhere to the standard of care, then the insurance company will refuse to compensate or pay the doctor for his services. As also, the standard of care is linked to licensure. And in licensure, if the doctor fails to adhere to the standard of care, he can be investigated by a licensing board and have his license removed. In this case, literally, for failure to commit medical homicide. And so that's got a lot of pressure on him to literally prescribe the lethal dose. And so the next question is, where does the standard of care really come from? Who writes this? Who has this authority? It turns out there's only three entities that can write the standard of care. One is a drug company. So drug companies develop the drugs, and they write the standard of care they believe to be the proper use of this drug. And, of course, they write this to maximize their revenue and the economic impact of the drug. Insurance companies write the standard of, care. They can write their guidelines, and they write the standard of care to maximize their particular profits. And then hospitals can also write the standard of care, and they write the standard of care, again, to ensure their economic viability is what the term is. Who cannot write the standard of care? Doctors cannot write the standard of care. So the doctor in a private office, I cannot say, wait a minute, I've seen three patients already. I followed the standard of care, and they have done very poorly. In fact, they died. So I'm going to write a new standard of care where I'm no longer going to use this particular medication. So the doctor does not have that authority. And guess who else is not allowed to write the standard of care? Patients. Patients are not permitted to write the standard of care. And this is another issue. And this has become a huge political issue. It was actually many years ago when people who had Lyme disease felt that they needed a longer course of antibiotics in order to get relief from their illness. And so what they would do is request, say to the doctor, please write me a prescription for more antibiotics. And doctors that did were prosecuted and lost their license. And so through a lot of litigation and political activity, they were able to get this one little standard of care altered slightly. But a patient is not permitted to initiate or alter the standard of care. And so it's the system where a doctor is obligated to follow rules that are inherently lethal and inherently biased, much to the detriment of his patient. So this is why there's really a huge, huge chance that your doctor is prescribing the lethal dose. I'd like to pause here and say that you're listening to Navigating the Disease Care System with Dr. Jennifer Daniels on Blog Talk Radio, and this is the Blake radio station. Now, I want people to call in and ask questions because I really want to make sure this is absolutely clear. It's really important that people understand this because so many people say, you know, I know a lot of people are dying from medical care, but it couldn't happen to me. It couldn't happen to me because my doctor is well-trained, my doctor is competent, and he's prescribing drugs according to the standard of care. And unfortunately, that's exactly how death by medicine occurs. And that actually puts you at very high risk of death. So I want to just take a little rundown of some causes of death by medicine that are not disputed by anyone. Pretty much it's agreed upon by the status quo, by the establishment, that these causes of death occur and they are real. So 107,000 people die every year from properly prescribed medications, from doctors doing the right thing and just following orders. And this is confirmed by the Journal of the American Medical Association. Then it's a figure of 92,000 deaths every year by doctors who are incompetent, doctors who deviate from the standard of care. And this is confirmed by the National Safety Council. These are the same folks who count car accidents and other such things. And then there's 100,000 deaths every year from hospital-acquired infections. And this is confirmed by the Extend the Cure study and several other studies that put the number at 100,000. There are studies that put this number much higher than that, but I'm going to use a low number of 100,000. And then there's 25,000 people every year that die because they go into hospitals and they get bed sores. Now, the grand total here is 324,000 people a year. Now, this is admittedly a very low figure because it only counts deaths associated with hospital admissions. It does not count deaths that occur when the standard of care is followed outside of a hospital setting. So this number may be one-half or even one-third of the total death toll. We do know it's 324,000. Now, this is a huge, huge, huge number. And so because it's so huge, I'd like to try and put it in perspective for you. The United States has been engaged in a war with Iraq. It's been going on for 8 years. And in that 8 years' time, 120,000 people have been murdered. Now, with all of our drone missiles, our fighter jets, artillery, all the arsenal, all the equipment, some implements of war, the only thing that's been able to happen is we've only gotten a death number of 107,000 over an 8 year period. So if you divide 120,000, if you divide that by 8, it comes down to about 15,000 per year. There are 32 million Iraqis. So 15,000 deaths a year, 32 million Iraqis. There's 311 million United States citizens. And the healthcare system is murdering at least 324,000 of them every year. This is a kill rate that is more than twice the kill rate our army has in a country where we are at war with that country and actually making a concerted effort to harm the people in that country. And so this really raises, we can only conclude one of two things. Either one, we need to replace our military with our healthcare system, and it would be more effective in terms of dealing with our enemies. In other words, we should simply invite our enemies to partake of our healthcare system free of charge, and then the kill rate would rise to a rate more effective than what's being experienced now with all of our military. Now, the other thing that this comparison brings up is, could it be that there is a concerted, coordinated effort on the part of, well, we don't want to name names, not necessary, but could there be a concerted effort to murder Americans? Is this really homicide? I'd like to suggest to you that this absolutely is homicide, that there's no other way to look at this except that it's homicide. And what I'd like to do through this show really is to make people more aware of this and to help them determine what their risk is. So I'd like to invite you to go to vitalitycapsules.com/find-out. So find out. So it's vitalitycapsules.com/find-out. And there you'll have a quick survey you can do, 3 questions, easy, and you can actually assess your risk of being a victim of homicide by medicine. This is really important because this is something people are actually at risk of dying, and people are dying all the time, left and right, because they don't really feel they're at risk. Now, another thing I like to say is the Iraqis know that they are at war. And I'll bet you that when they see an armed American soldier, they do not run up to him and ask him for an appointment. They don't pay for parking, make an appointment, and stand in line to get murdered. In fact, I'll bet you dollars to donuts, they probably run the other way. They're running high. They might even stay very quiet, hoping that the soldier will walk by their house and not realize that they're there. Another thing that they don't do is they don't take out a special insurance policy to make sure that their executioner gets paid a little extra once they die. So what the Iraqis have done, and I think everyone, other people in every war that we've gotten involved in, is they have taken evasive action. And they have tried to make really sure that the people who've arrived on their soil to execute them do not receive any reward for doing so. Now, it might be that a similar posture is called for on the part of patients and everyday citizens. So, next I'd like to talk about the other piece to the puzzle, and that's the hospital. The question is your hospital planning your death? Is it possible that before you showed up at the hospital, that the hospital put a few rules in place, some policies in place, that literally increase your chances of dying while you're at the hospital? Now, this could really take hours and hours to talk about because it's just so fascinating. I'm going to cover just a few biggies. One is the hospital actually writes protocols that doctors are obligated to follow. And doctors have to follow these protocols as a condition of keeping their hospital privileges. And these protocols have become so objectionable over time. And many doctors who've had a long-term relationship with their patients have found these protocols so damaging and so objectionable that they've either refused to follow them or, in my case, in addition to refusing to follow them, I just stopped using the hospital. So now many hospitals have what they call a hospitalist. And the hospitalist is a doctor who exclusively takes care of hospitalized patients and follows every single hospital protocol, no matter the outcome. Now, again, if the doctor follows the hospital protocol, first he's an employee of the hospital, but he's held harmless. There is insurance called malpractice that pays any judgments that may result as a consequence of the care that is provided. But it's even more than that. And to really give you a look at that, I wanted to talk about a recent article that Newsweek wrote. And it said, hospitals can kill you. And their headline is, bad doctors, prescription errors, surgical slips, and medical mistakes injure or kill hundreds of thousands of Americans every year. And why patients are kept in the dark. This is written by a Marty Macri, who's a doctor. Now, this is a little misleading, and I think a better way to phrase this is good doctors, accurate prescriptions, properly done surgeries, and medical breakthroughs injure or kill hundreds of thousands of Americans every year, and why patients are kept in the dark. And this is really what it is, folks, that this medical homicide that's going on is actually the result of properly provided healthcare provided according to the standard of care, according to protocol that doctors are actually compelled to follow. And the posture that these deaths are due to errors leads to a solution that compels doctors to follow existing deadly protocols to the letter and murder even more patients by medicine. So this deliberate deception can only be described as homicide. So the strategy is very much premeditated and planned. Now, some people might say, well, you know, it's some secret committee trying to thin the herd or kill Americans. Possibly, but I really think it's just motivated by profit. It's just a heck of a lot more profitable to give a medicine up until the point where it's deadly rather than stop halfway there and use half as much drugs or a fourth as much medication. So it's simply a heck of a lot more profitable. And also, if you prescribe drugs up to the deadly dose, the lethal dose, then the patient's going to require special monitoring, special intervention. So a lot of things are going to be more profitable when you work in the area of the deadly dose. And so describing death by medicine as an accident really doesn't do the system justice. And this death of patients at the hands of doctors happens, like I said, easily hundreds of thousands of times a year, at least 325,000. That's a low estimate. There are other sources that, like Gary Null, whose estimate is as high as 900,000, and you really can't argue with his numbers. Now, I've actually taken videos on my site, again, vitalitycapsules.com. I would go to /find-out so you can do your own little survey to see if you're at risk of being murdered. Now, the superficial attribution of these deaths to accident is really beyond naive, because even the most naive and trusting patient would have to conclude that these accidents are happening with amazing regularity, something similar to the sun rising. These are not accidents. This is murder. And I think the solution is somebody needs to prosecute. So the next time that a relative of yours dies and you think, geez, I think that medical care killed him, don't call the lawyer for malpractice. Call the district attorney and demand the district attorney look into it. Now, you can, of course, file malpractice if you want to, but the point is, only once these individuals, whether it's the doctors, the nurses, whoever, are held accountable in terms of a criminal level, will anything be done about it. Now, in this article, they said that American citizen patients should expect better from an industry that is 17% of the economy. Now, this is really a ludicrous statement. How is this ludicrous? Because if harmful care were eliminated, healthcare would only be 3.4% of the economy. It's only by harming patients and murdering patients and committing medical homicide that the industry could possibly grow to 17% of the economy, because there just isn't that much sickness to go around unless the industry creates its own sickness. So some of you might actually be wondering how I get that figure of 3.4%. Well, it turns out that 20% of the care provided in the hospitals is harmful, and that's a figure from this article in Newsweek. And it turns out that when a patient is harmed, on average, the hospital gets or collects four times as much in revenue for the hospital stay. That's another figure from a different source. And so 20% times 4 is 80%. So 80% of the money spent on healthcare is spent for care that's actually harmful. And so 80% of 17 is 13.6% of all the care, or the money spent on medical care, is spent for care that's actually harmful. And you subtract the 13.6 from the 17%, and voila, 3.4% of the economy is the piece that would be occupied by healthcare if the industry limited itself only to beneficial care. Now, this may be an overestimate, but it's certainly a good starting point. Now, I'll bet you, if people's health bills were limited to only 3.4% of their annual income or of the GNP, people probably wouldn't even feel they needed insurance. And there's the rub. There's actually a conflict of interest for the insurance companies to want to eliminate all harmful care, because if they did eliminate harmful care, they wouldn't be needed because care would be so affordable. And so this is really the situation that we face. Now, in the case in this Newsweek article, the patient had a cancer. They didn't know what kind. They wanted to do a surgery to determine what kind. And the patient's feeling was she was very old, on in years, and she'd rather just go home and spend time with her family. But, a lot of pressure was put on her to have the surgery. The benefits were overestimated. The risks were underestimated. Again, this is in the words of the person writing the article. And during the surgery, a biopsy needle slipped and hit an important artery. Now, in the article, they would call that a mistake. And, of course, I differ with that. That's not true. Could not possibly have been a mistake. How do I know? I wasn't even there. How do I know it was not a mistake? Because when it comes to surgery, they say the doctor will do surgery. However, a properly trained doctor may also have the following events happen at surgery. And these are routine things that often happen and that may happen, and you understand and accept these risks. And so what's happened is these things are not accidents. These are routine things that happen in the course of surgery when a competent doctor does surgery. So they're not an accident. They are expected. And so this patient's outcome, which was basically that she ended up in the hospital for several weeks, went home and died soon after, was not an accident. It was actually expected. And the person writing the article was surprised by this. He was so surprised, he went back and asked the doctor, hey, this is an awful thing that's happened. You know, maybe you shouldn't have done the surgery. And so the head of the surgical department said, patients don't know what they want. We have to decide for them. And that this outcome was the best outcome possible. Now, this is a tip-off. The tip-off is that the surgical department head has such a pat answer for such a horrendous event. In other words, this event is a usual, ordinary event that the department head was fully prepared to explain. And again, when these things happen, a response might be to prosecute not only the surgeon, but the knowledgeable department head. So you have a murder, and you have an accessory to murder, homicide and accessory to homicide. And so we retrain our minds to think of these things as homicide, and I think it puts patients in a much better position to be safe and to keep themselves safe. Now, we hear a lot about these errors, right, making healthcare costs rise. Well, what to an outsider might be healthcare costs, the hospital is actually revenue. This is revenue. This is serious money. This is very, very, very important stuff. So when you say this is an undesirable healthcare cost, it may be an undesirable healthcare cost to the recipient, but it's a very desirable healthcare costs or consequence to the hospital and to the doctors involved. So I'd like to take a pause here for station ID. I'd like to say this is Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul. This is Dr. Jennifer Daniels. And the title of the show is Navigating the Disease Creation System, and this episode is the lethal dose, why your doctor is prescribing it. I'd like to continue also and mention other aspects of the hospital that contribute to patients' adverse outcome. One of these is something called standing orders. Whenever a person is admitted to a hospital, there's standing orders routinely for sleep, for indigestion, and for pain. Most patients survive the indigestion orders. However, it's very common for a patient to admit to the hospital, have difficulty sleeping, the nurse administers a sleeping pill, and the patient never wakes up. And this is something I personally witnessed during my training times, and it was absolutely appalling when it happened. And, of course, when it happened, there was no investigation. There were no questions asked. It was just considered, oh, well. And I was really shaken by that. However, this happens frequently. It happens all the time. And same thing with pain medicine. You have a person comes into the hospital. Maybe the person's a little bit small for their age. Maybe they don't weigh that much. And they receive a one-size-fits-all dose. And that's all she wrote, and they go home in a pine box. So standing orders are a major, major hazard to the health of patients in hospitals. And, of course, as we mentioned before, the whole paternalistic attitude that patients are ignorant and the hospital knows best, and the hospital simply makes decisions of course, in its own financial interest, often for detriment of the patient, with the fig leaf of paternalism. The other thing that happens is when you are admitted to the hospital, it doesn't matter who you are, your insurance card is scanned. And, of course, they determine if your insurance will pay for the hospital admission. And you might say, well, that's reasonable. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but we'll grant you that. But it doesn't stop there. Then your insurance card is scanned to see every single test the hospital offers that your insurance will pay for on that admission. And there are people called quality assurance nurses, and they circulate in the hospital. And if you're in the hospital and your doctor hasn't ordered that several thousand dollar MRI test for your sprained ankle, but you have insurance that can be expected to pay for it, put a little sticky on your chart saying, doctor, have you considered ordering the MRI? Have you considered ordering this very expensive test? And so these are stickies attached to the chart. The doctor sees them, and all of a sudden he's in a difficult position here. No, he doesn't think that test is really needed because he's figured out that the patient has a condition that the test really wouldn't add that much information. However, if he doesn't order the test, then the hospital does not get revenue. Then he's not adhering to the standard of care for the hospital. And he may find himself having his hospital privileges limited. And hospital privileges are limited often in a very subtle way. If you're a surgeon, you just notice you're not getting as many hours in the operating room. And that really cuts into your income. So when they scan the insurance company card of a patient and subject the patient to every last test the insurance will pay for, many of these tests actually have danger associated with it, whether it's high radiation, whether it's, believe it or not, falling off the x-ray table and cracking your skull open. This happens with alarming frequency. Whether it's an allergic reaction to the dye from the x-ray test, and whether it's just as simple as Harvard anemia, and that means that so much blood is taken from the patient that he becomes anemic because of all the blood taken from him for blood tests. And so these things actually really happen routinely when patients go into the hospital. And the Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee, or such a committee, every hospital has one, and it meets with drug company representatives throughout the year. And they debate which drugs will or will not be used in the hospital. And they negotiate. These are very, you know, some cases economic, some cases convenient negotiations. And there's not ever a patient at the table during those negotiations. When they decide, okay, which drugs are we going to carry? We're going to exclude these other drugs. And so a patient can come into a hospital with drugs maybe they were doing pretty well on, and all the drugs will be stopped and replaced with the drugs the hospital agreed on during the course of its many meetings with drug reps throughout the year. This actually happened to one of my patients. And I admitted the patient to the hospital, wrote the orders, many of them for medications the patient was already on and quite stable on, and then additional orders and tests that were needed, and went home. The patient was in emergency admission middle of the night. I come back the next morning. The orders were totally rewritten by some unnamed committee, and I had not been called. And the patient was being put on drugs that had no track record of being of any benefit to him and probably would have been had a lot of different reactions. And so it was really a tremendous amount of my time, which I was not compensated for, and getting things changed. I told the hospital, look, if you don't want to use these drugs because it's not profitable for you, don't worry. I'll have the family bring in the drugs from home, and you can just have the nurses dispense those drugs or have the patient take those. What I did not realize was the hospital can't bill $5 for or $10 for an aspirin that the patient brought in from home. And so that really, while it was solving my patient's problem of getting the drugs he needed, it was not solving the hospital problem, which was being able to bill a certain amount of money. And so this is a very you know, these are very dangerous practices that routinely happen in hospitals. And patients are deceived about this. And so a lot of times patients will go to the hospital, and the hospital will have a doctor who's a hospitalist. And the patient will say, oh, thank God, I have a hospitalist on the case, someone who specializes in hospitalized patients. And they don't realize that what the hospitalist really specializes in is the standard of care as needed to protect the profits of the hospital. And so the patient thinks that they are in really good hands, and actually they might be in a worse situation than they ever imagined. And so these are some of the things that hospitals do before you even show up that literally guarantee that your stay in the hospital is going to be especially dangerous or especially problematic. And so I want people to stop by vitalitycapsules.com/find-out and complete the little questionnaire so you can see if you're at risk. And it's a three-question questionnaire. It's very simple. And you know, your risk is going to be either low, medium, or high. But it's better to know. People say, know your number, know your cholesterol number. Well, you need to know your risk. You need to know your risk of being a victim of medical homicide, because it's something that catches 325,000 people a year easily, totally blindsides them, where they have no clue that this is happening. And the darndest people who are otherwise sensible are caught up in this trap, and many of them don't even know what has happened to them. Sometimes the family suspects, and sometimes they don't. Now, I'd like to say to anyone out there, if it ever happens to you, or you have a near-death hospital experience, you know, definitely talk to the district attorney. That would be the person to talk to. And I think if more people start approaching a district attorney's office and registering complaints, then something will be done about this. Because it turns out that after you practice medicine for a while, in the hospital, you can ask any doctor, any nurse, even the clerk at the nursing station who handles phone calls and paperwork. She'll see paperwork come by, and it'll have XYZ drug on it. She'll say, oh boy, this patient won't be living very long. She'll transcribe the orders. The nurse will transcribe it. It'll go down to the pharmacy. The drug will come up. The nurse will hang the drug. The drug will drip into the patient's arm or however they administer the drug. But what I'm saying is these deaths all have a pattern to them. People can see these patterns, and they know that when this particular drug is started, oh boy, cover your eyes, here it comes, that this patient's not going to be alive very long. And if people felt that they had a risk of being prosecuted or charged with homicide when they stand by and let this happen, then it's a, whoa, 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 the doctor administered this drug, I'm out of here, I want my hands on it, I'm going home, calling in sick. And pretty soon you won't be able to find doctors, nurses, or personnel to administer this deadly therapy. Because really, it's a committee. It's not a one-on-one kill where one person kills a patient. It's a whole group effort. And many people involved in the effort are not even aware of the role that they play. And many people involved in this effort are sincerely concerned about patients and sincerely feel that they are helping. And I'll give you an example. When you calculate all these numbers, how many people die by medical homicide, the number comes down to a pretty high number, anywhere from 20 to 40% of all people every year who die by medical homicide. Let's take the number 20% because it's a lower number. Let's be generous. If you have someone, so say an attempted murder, and the ambulance shows up on the scene, they scoop up the body, the person's breathing, they take them to the hospital, of the patients that die, 20% of them were actually killed by the medical care they received, not by their assailant. And there are people sitting in jail serving time for homicides that were actually committed by the healthcare system. Now that's a shocking thought. You just really think about that. So this really touches many people's lives. And so you have the poor ambulance attendant thought they were doing the right thing, brought the person to the emergency room. You have the emergency room clerk checking the patient in, following these policies and procedures, not realizing that the person she's assisting is maybe destined to be a victim of medical homicide. And so all along the chain, and obviously if anyone anywhere along the chain had refused to do their part, the person might be alive. So I calculate it takes at least 6 people to successfully complete medical homicide. And if it's described as medical homicide, then you will have more people, refusing to participate and refusing to do their part to facilitate the homicide or the death. Even better yet, you have patients who will just jump up off the stretcher and say, you know what, I'm out of here. And I think that would be a wonderful thing. And people would be a lot healthier and have a lot more benefit. Now, we only have about 10 minutes left, so I'd like to ask people also to please go to my website, vitalitycapsules.com, leave a comment. Let me know what you thought of the show, topics you'd like me to cover in the future, and also another name for the show. Right now it's Navigating the Disease Creation System, but maybe there's another catchier title that might better describe the effort to educate potential victims to their vulnerability, and as we get into it, talk about other choices, other things people can do. In my medical practice, I was absolutely shocked and appalled when I actually gave people a choice of doing nothing. Like, you know what? You could take this drug, or you know what? You could do nothing. And the patients were like, huh? Said, yeah, you could do nothing. And it's amazing how liberating that is, an option that you can actually do nothing. And then, of course, you can go the other end. You can do lifestyle changes, diet, cleansing, herbs, vitamins, all those things too. We can talk about those things as well. So I'd like to hear from people. vitalitycapsules.com/find-out. You can take our easy quiz there, and you can leave some suggestions for radio show names and also future topics. Next week we're going to talk about the hypertension hoax. Or I should say, excuse me, the heart disease hoax. It's really important, the heart disease hoax. And understand what the heart disease risk really is, or even better yet, what heart disease is. Most people think that heart disease is a disease that affects the heart. And I'm here to tell you, that's not the way it's classified. So next week we're going to talk about the heart disease hoax and who's really dying of heart disease, what your real risk is, and what these medicines may or may not be doing for you, and things you can do to drastically cut your heart disease risk by as much as 69% without even taking a single pill. So that's for next week, the heart disease hoax and how you can cut your heart disease risk by as much as 69% without taking a single pill. Not a single pill. I want to say, even the cholesterol folks only guarantee you a 20% reduction. So I'm going to share with you the latest information. This is research done not by the alternative out there people, but research done by regular conventional establishment medicine showing how people can reduce their risk by 69%. Without taking a single pill. And I'm telling you, I was just so excited when I found that out. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you next week. So I hope that you'll tell all your friends and come hear the good news and really a message of hope and a message of living longer and really doing better. So again, if I could say that the lethal dose, your doctor is prescribing it. Why is he prescribing it? He's prescribing it because it's the standard of care. It's the standard of care, and if he doesn't prescribe it, he can lose his license. If he doesn't prescribe it, your insurance company won't pay him. If he doesn't prescribe the lethal dose, he loses his hospital privileges. If he doesn't prescribe the lethal dose, he's open to malpractice. If he doesn't prescribe the lethal dose, he gets a lot of negative feedback. I'll just tell you one quick story. We've got 5 minutes left. Of a time when I refused to prescribe the lethal dose and it really met up with incredible resistance. There's this sleeping pill out there called Ambien. And lately, they finally got the word out, Ambien is deadly. It will kill you. And this is about, 10 years ago. Must have been 13 years ago. A patient of mine had difficulty sleeping, so I prescribed Ambien, the lowest dose. And she says, I don't know, doctor. It really gets me to sleep. And I know she was shuffling. I said, I think you're doing the Ambien shuffle here. She said, what's that? I said, well, the Ambien shuffle is that where you shuffle your feet around after you're taking too much Ambien. So let's cut that back. So we finally decided that her dose was 1/4 pill. She took 1/4 of a pill. She slept through the night just beautifully. I said, okay, great, no problem. So I wrote for 7 pills, 1/4 pill each night at bedtime. There you go. Because you can only write a month at a time for sleeping pills. I wrote for 8 pills, it would be a month and a day, so that wouldn't work. Okay, so he wrote for 7 pills. She goes to the pharmacy, and I get a phone call. Dr. Daniels, we cannot fill this prescription. I said, why can't you fill a prescription? Because this prescription does not follow the standard of care. Standard of care, she must get a full tablet every night at bedtime. She's got to rewrite this prescription. So literally, unless I prescribe a deadly dose of that pill for this lady, they were not going to fill it. So, of course, I had to take it. She came back to the office. I wrote another prescription, and I told her to take 1 pill as needed. And so we agreed that she would go home and cut each one of those pills into quarters, and because I had to give her 30 pills, she had enough pills for 4 months. But so this is just to let you know that when a doctor tries not to give the lethal dose, he gets resistance at every turn. Whether it's the pharmacist who says, you're not following the standard of care. Whether it's the nurse who says, you're not following the standard of care. I'm going to report you. I even have one patient who is, whenever you open a practice, a medical practice, people come to you and say, doctor, I need narcotics, need a lot of them, and you got to help me, you got to give me narcotics. And so before I opened my medical practice, I made up my mind that as a policy, I was not going to use narcotics. I was going to use other forms of pain relief, but not narcotics. And so this patient came in demanding narcotics, and I just told him, you know what? I'm just not going to do that. I do not prescribe narcotics. So the patient actually complained to the medical society and said, that doctor needs her license taken away because she won't prescribe narcotics. So, of course, I worked my way out of that little awkward moment. But these are the things that your doctor is facing when he attempts to not prescribe the deadly dose. So we're coming to the end of the hour here. This has been Dr. Jeff for Navigating the Disease Creation System, the lethal dose, why is your doctor prescribing it? And this is Blake Radio, Rainbow Soul, and look forward to seeing you next week, Tuesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
make-believe.